Coming up on the Assassins podcast, we've got Rob May, serial entrepreneur and CTO and co-founder of Dianthus, jumping on the podcast, talking about Rob's decision to start a company that wasn't SaaS first and how Dianthus is disrupting the e-commerce space. We go back to talk about the early stages of AI and automation in the workplace and what Rob feels is really missing for that category to take off, reflecting on some of the early insights from the Slack bot ecosystem days. And then we touch on industries that are ripe for disruption through the practical applications of automation and the three criteria that make them great candidates to target and disrupt. Rob is also an incredible angel investor, so he shares some insight into some of the things that he's thinking about and categories he's looking at potentially investing in toward the end of the show. So, all right, without further ado, Assassins, let's get it started. See them dollar signs, hustle, grind. Assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs, assassin's state of mind, assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs way above the bottom line, assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs, assassin's state of mind, assassin's state of mind, hustle, grind. See them dollar signs way above the bottom line, assassin's state of mind. They say money over everything, everything, gauge in the game. Shopping for a wedding ring, salary, startups, crypto, stock exchange, appreciate it. What is going on, everybody? Happy Friday. It's a little rainy Friday here in Portland, Oregon. We've got a great episode lined up today on the Assassins podcast. This is your host, Justin Vandehey, where we're helping first-time entrepreneurs make that leap from zero to one and build better, stronger businesses. This week on the Assassins pod, we've got a really awesome guest on. He's a good friend of mine from early days of Disco, early days of the bot ecosystem. He is one of the most unique assassins we probably had on the show thus far. Rob May, welcome to the Assassins podcast. Would love maybe we could just start with a quick intro on yourself and let's get into it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Justin. So I'm a hardware engineer by training. So I started my career doing computer chip design, ASICs and FPGAs, if you guys, anybody listening knows what those are. And then I got into sales engineering, business development, worked for a couple of startups, and then now I've started three companies. So I started a company called Backupify late 2008, did backup for cloud computing applications, and sold that company in December of 2014, and started doing some angel investing then, which I think I'll talk a little bit about later. Then in parallel, started a company called Tala, which is where we met Justin, you know, talking about the bot ecosystem, early Slack bot builders, and trying to figure out where all that was going, because it was not clear. And Tala did not do as well as Backupify. So Tala kind of got stuck in that area of having too much revenue to shut down, but not enough revenue to get more funding. So we merged it in with another company. It's still going, the product is still live, and you know, TBD what'll happen there. I left there and went to become a general partner at PJC, which is a seed stage venture firm here in Boston. I led all their robotics and AI investments. So led some really cool investments. Probably the two that have done the best so far, I think, from my PJC investing, Synthesis.ai, which is a synthetic data company. So they have an API that creates human faces that don't exist anywhere in the world that you can put into your data sets. A lot of reasons you might want to do that. And then a company called Native Voice, which is super cool because Native Voice allows you, instead of saying like, you know, hey, Google, open the Uber app or whatever, it gives brands their own wake word.
Mm.
You can say, hey, McDonald's, hey, Starbucks, hey, Uber, and open up your own voice connection to those companies, which I think is super cool and has a lot of potential. And when I was at PJC, I loved investing. You know, I did 10 or 11 investments while I was there. I've done another 70 or 80 personally. And some of those are really small, like $5,000 through AngelList or whatever, right? They're not all big personal investments, but I had this idea for what became Dianthus. We incubated it and I decided to leave PJC and come run this full time as the CTO. I hired a CEO who's a longtime friend of mine because I didn't want to be a CEO again. But what Dianthus does is we build machine learning software for e-commerce applications, but we do not sell the software. We acquire e-commerce companies that are, you know, 2 to 20 million in revenue. You know, we acquire them with debt, and we use our software to grow them a lot faster than the previous owners were. And so it's a different kind of model. And, you know, I think we'll get into that a little bit on the podcast, why we decided to take that approach rather than make Dianthus into a SaaS company that just sold the software brands. So yeah, so that's where I am today. I also should talk about, we talked a little bit about content. I write a newsletter called Inside AI. If you're interested in artificial intelligence, I don't write it every day. They pay somebody to write the news, but I write the weekend commentary on what's going on in the AI ecosystem.
Awesome. And you're on the East Coast, right, Rob?
Yeah, based in Boston.
Based in Boston. Very cool. Yeah, that's great. I think subtle transition back to the early days. I know from your experience investing in the space, investing in robotics, you know, founding Tala, we've had a lot of conversations in the early years about AI and sort of more around automation in the workplace as you were pioneering there with Tala. And obviously in cycles like this, things accelerate rapidly and the things can evolve rapidly. And I was curious where you see things as they are today, you know, as far as how far along are we in where certain functions are being automated and in different industries or job functions. How have you seen the technology evolve since you started Tala?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the chatbot side of this and the messaging side of this, I think there were a couple of approaches early on. There were some of the early Slack bots did a really smart thing, and I think this has worked out well, which was they used the bots to gather information. You know, we were talking before the podcast about Polly. You know, we're friends with Samir. He was early in this as well with us, and they've done a good job of like using it for polls and getting information and stuff like that. And I think that's a great use case. And then there's a more scripted use case, which is to deliver information, but deliver information that is relatively well-structured and well-defined. And I think that's actually worked out well. I think the thing that is missing that some of us thought would happen was, you know, the like real natural language processing explosion for these chatbots, where they would just be able to say stuff without a lot of structure. And that just didn't happen. If I look at one of the mistakes that Tala made, we were taking down that like hardcore AI path. And if you look at who won that space, those companies that won, Ada, for example, really started with just simple support scripted bots. And that's probably what we should have done. So I think the really complex natural language piece interactions still haven't played out very well for startups. But the industry is changing. They have now what are called foundational models. And these foundational models in AI are these very, very large pre-trained generative models, is what they call them, because they can generate text or video or whatever. And they're trained by, you know, DeepMind and Google Brain and OpenAI and Microsoft and companies like this, and available for the rest of us to use. And you can put your own models on top of them to sort of tweak things. I think the generative models are the foundational models are going to help us get there. With respect to broader automation, again, what you've seen there is a non-AI version of it. It's mostly RPA, you know, robotic process automation, a lot of scripting stuff that really came out of non-cloud-based tools. So the early use case for robotic process automation was, I have to copy a lot of data from this application to this application. I don't want to replace either application, but I'm tired of paying somebody, you know, $15 an hour just to cut and paste all day. It seems like this should be automatable. Well, it is. And that's sort of where UiPath and some of those companies got started. And they've started to move into machine learning, but the demand is still there so much for these simple on-premise automations that market's still growing pretty aggressively. But I think we'll get there. The big problem with doing really complex automations for workflows is we don't have a labeled data set to do it. So, you know, the way that machine learning works today, you need a lot of labeled data or annotated data, if people might call it. And so when you're doing something, when you're going through your day and working, how do you capture that? How do you capture, well, why did you put that in that cell in the spreadsheet? Why did you copy and paste that number rather than another number? The way that we would solve this problem would be to capture that data as you're working. Well, if we did that, if we built an interface to do that, it would actually be more complex than the interfaces used today. And one of the big things about SaaS, you know, some of the people listening here are probably a little older like I am and remember a time before SaaS where you had to It was a pain in the ass to buy software. Like, even if you're buying marketing software or finance software, you had to go through IT, you had to procure a server, you had to install it on the server. You typically had a big installation fee. You know, sometimes if it was complicated enough, somebody came to do it from the software company. And then SaaS was like amazing. It was like, you just need a credit card and a browser. It's so simple. And we've gotten so used to that low friction thing that if you really want to do a lot of cool AI stuff and you want to gather data, you're going to introduce some friction again, because there's friction to gathering that data. And it's not how we think. And we don't want to slow down our work, even if it means that maybe after a year of gathering that data, we could, you know, we could automate something cool and get rid of some of the work. And so it's a little bit like training a person. And so I think the workplace automation stuff is still very scripted, much more than I definitely thought it would be. A big mistake of mine in the early days in how I approached it. But there are a few companies that are starting to get there and think about it in new ways and capture that data. And I think those companies will lead the way in AI-centric automation.
Are there certain industries that you feel are progressing faster or slower than others? I know there was obviously a huge push in ticketing support, you know, with Tala, but I'm just curious to see if you've noticed any specific industries that have made the move or are progressing any faster than others.
Yeah, you really needed sort of three things to industries that had three characteristics, right? One, you needed semi-structured data. So these are areas where maybe you have a lot of forms, or maybe you have a lot of, you know, for natural language processing, you have a lot of questions, but they're relatively similar. They're not wildly open-ended. So you need this sort of like semi-structured data. You know, a good example is mortgage applications. You know, they vary by state and they all have the same kinds of fields. They're all going to ask for your social security number. They're all going to ask where you were. That might be in a different location on different applications, but you know it's there. And so you can train a machine learning model to look for that field and then find that field and put it in. So there are use cases, you know, like that. So that's one of the things that you need. The second thing is you need a user base that's open to it, that needs automation. There are areas of the economy and industry where people just still don't like that. But obviously customer support, you know, administrative tasks are pretty good for that. So you know, those are two of the three things. You know, and then I think you need a place where you have a lot of what I would call low value clerical types of tasks where, you know, you can, they require a human to do, but they're a little bit mindless.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get an AI to design something complicated right now, but there's a whole category of work out there that, you know, like those mortgage applications, again, like a human can figure out which field is the social security number.
Right.
So I think you need those three things. And I think when you find those three things, I think that's where automation has started. And it's kind of at those intersections in terms of at least what I've seen out there.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great insight. Shifting gears a little bit, I'd love to talk with you a little bit more about Dianthus. And the model that y'all have built is fascinating. What was the catalyst for jumping off, the insight that you had initially when you got it going? And I'd love to just hear, your thinking and the rationale behind the model and where you see it going.
Yeah. So when I was a VC, I was looking at e-commerce, machine learning applications for e-commerce. And my thesis that I started with was e-commerce is getting more quantitative, more data-driven, more algorithmic. You know, we've seen that trend already. It's being run more by, you know, computers and software and stuff. But over the next 20 years, it should be won by quants, not brand marketers, sort of the way that finance has been, you know, Renaissance Technologies, DE Shaw, Two Sigma, like, they hire physicists and mathematicians. They don't hire finance people. And so I see e-commerce going in a similar direction. So I started looking for tools that we could bet on in that space. And I ran into this problem. There were two problems with it. One is a lot of the e-commerce tools have really high churn rates for SaaS companies. And the reason they do is because when you're dealing with the machine learning model, you know, when you have a SaaS tool like DocuSign, instant value. You drop your document in there, you label the fields, you send it to somebody, they sign it. They've saved you time already, right? That's cool. With these machine learning tools, so like, let's say you look at a tool that'll generate ads for you, or Microsoft has this cool function that'll generate PowerPoint designs, right? So you look at something like that. Let's say I was a standalone company. They have really high churn rates. Why do they have high churn rates? They have high churn rates because the models don't work well in the beginning. It takes time. You have to think of it like training a person. So what happens is people try it out for 2 days and they go, well, this sucks, and they cancel. The second thing is the tools don't really capture a lot of value. So when you think about a SaaS tool, what's interesting about SaaS is you're normally aiding the workflow of a specific employee, right? So SaaS kind of very focused into like you sell to this person or this person. And so if that person costs $150,000 and you need three of those people for your size company, you're spending $450K a year. If I can make that you only need, you know, two of those people instead of three, and I can save you $150K a year, I can probably get paid $25,000 to $50,000 for that. You get 2/3 of the value, 3/4 of the value. I get the rest as a SaaS provider. And that's a pretty good split. It's not what I saw in the e-commerce space when it comes to machine learning. It might be when it came to traditional e-com software. But what's happened in the machine learning space is like, I give you a model that helps with your pricing or your couponing or, you know, whatever. And it improves your bottom line by $8 million. And you pay me $25,000 a year. And probably the way that needs to work is like infrastructure-based pricing or something. I need to take a percentage of revenue or revenue lift or something like that. But like the market's not really there to take that. So I looked at this and I was like, well, the value, like this is going to happen, but the value, as an investor, you always think about new technology stacks. And what happens is as new things come along, sometimes they create whole new stacks and sometimes they just replace pieces of stacks. And you're always thinking about where does the value accrue? Because you might do 20% of the work and accrue 10% of the value, and that still might be an okay business. Or you might do 20% of the work and accrue 60% of the value of that new technology stack. You know, do you want to be, a perfect example is like Google, building Google is probably less work than all the online publishing that happens. Google captures the majority of value, not the publishers, right?
Right.
Overall. And so that's sort of how you want to think about it. So we're looking at this and I was just like, well, the value is going to accrue to the brands from the machine learning tools. But then you have this weird problem where most of the brands are not very sophisticated. A lot of your best and brightest in tech don't go into e-commerce with the exception of like Amazon or Walmart. So anyway, so we initially said, well, we're not going to invest here. And then I saw some of these aggregators, Thrasio and Perch, and they were buying up these Amazon stores, which are really easy to integrate. And it gave us this idea of like, well, what if we built software? We're the software company, but we just bought the brands. So what we can do now on average is we can structure the payment. So let's say we're going to buy a brand that's $2.5 million drops to the bottom line every year, right? They'll typically call that seller discretionary earnings. So it's all their, you know, net profit plus, you know, the seller's salary and some other expenses they run through the business. So let's say the SDE is $2.5 million. In this market, you might be able to get that pretty cheap because multiples are down. But let's say in a normal market, you might pay 4, 4.5 times that. So let's say 4 to make the math easy. So you're going to pay $10 million for that business. What we can do is we can typically structure that and the sellers will take a payment that's like 50% upfront. So $5 million upfront and then 2.5 after year one, 2.5 after year two. Those payments might be guaranteed. They might be slightly performance-based. We can grow the cash flow fast enough to cover those new payments with the incremental cash flow. So not the cash that we're, you know, they already had $2.5 million coming, you know, from the business. Will in the year number one, will at least double that seller discretionary earnings number to another $2.5 million. So that impact we have on the business kind of gives us those last two payments for free.
Yeah.
And what's beautiful about it is the front payment that we have, we can finance half that with debt. So you don't need a lot of equity. So for $2.5 million in equity, I can basically acquire $10 million worth of value. And in 18 months, I can grow it to be worth like $30 million worth of value, which is a 10x return because I'm arbitraging like the performance of machine learning, some financial engineering, you know, and some stuff like that. So it's a super cool business model. We've closed on 4 businesses. We're about $30 million in revenue at the time of recording this podcast. We'll be at $100 million by the end of the year, I think.
Wow.
Because we have some businesses lined up and it's super fun because we're building and deploying all these machine learning tools for these businesses to, you know, models to help with pricing, to optimize their ads, using natural language processing to write better ads for them automatically and, excuse me, all kinds of cool stuff.
What's the selection process like when you're looking at those to fill out the portfolio? Is there quantitative inputs that you're taking in?
Yeah. So we use a bunch of robotic process automation actually to do a lot of scraping and we tap into some APIs and we try to get some insights into what companies are doing and what companies seem to be interesting and sort of in our wheelhouse. And I would say we probably have an initial discussion with 400, maybe 500 companies a month.
Wow.
We have a small M&A team, 3 people. And then probably 20 or 30 of them will make it to further analysis. So that would be, we believe there's some kind of defensible moat there that is in place or that they're building. You know, we believe that it meets our criteria. Sometimes they're too big or too small, not worth our time. We believe they're open to the kind of financing strategy we want. And then more importantly, we believe that our tools can actually help grow the business pretty fast.
Yeah.
So, you know, even in this market where everybody's talking about e-com's down and all this kind of stuff, the first cohort of businesses that we acquired last year, we're doing $15 million in revenue. We've grown the revenue 40%, and we've grown the bottom line about 300%. There's so much flexibility in the model. When you own a bunch of brands and you have a bunch of customer relationships, it helps you get around some of the privacy issues because you can cross promote because you own both brands and both customers.
Yeah.
We have all these automation tools that make it, you know, easier. You know, we can catch trends and all that kind of stuff and respond faster. You can shift resources around between brands faster. So it's a really super interesting model, and it's a lot of fun to work on.
For sure. What is the relationship like with the founders of these companies? I mean, I'm sure it has a partnership vibe, you know, across brands and portfolios. It also just seems like a freaking lot to manage. You're spinning a lot of plates. So how do you standardize that work and keep everything going?
Well, the standardization, a lot of it is abstracted away by machine learning. So we have a lot of machine learning in the operations. The machines make a lot of decisions. They do a lot of stuff. And so we don't have a competitive analysis person who needs to go understand one industry and another industry, et cetera. Like, we just have a tool that does all that and just make recommendations for how we should change our pricing based on competitor responses. So there are things like that that simplify it. With the founders, it really depends. We've had cases where we've kept the founders on. Like, we have two founders that are still with us and took roles within Dianthus.
Yeah.
But I would say in the majority of the businesses, you know, the founders might stay 3 to 6 months. Really depends on their situation. Most of these businesses that are 2 to 20 million in the e-commerce space, they outsource. It might be the founder might work part time on it. They might have three businesses like these.
Yeah.
And, you know, they work part time on it. And so they'll stay on for 3 to 6 months and help us with the transition. And then they outsource a lot of stuff. So that's, you know, that's pretty easy. And then also there's a lot of just human expertise and scalability about doing things that we can do because we're a bigger company and we've got 100 people that they can't do when there are two full-time people and six, you know, consultants. So even before the AI has an impact, sometimes we can make really quick, profitable changes to the company.
Yeah, that's great. I know we're coming to the top of the time here. Wanted to round it out, and I've been asking this question of serial assassins, serial entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. What would Rob May, the co-founder of Tala, tell Rob, the co-founder of Backupify, if you had the ability to do so, if at all? Like, what advice would you share?
I think there's two things. One is, I don't really, like, people talk about the ups and downs that you go through in a startup. And then you're there in the middle of it and you still are like, okay, I knew this was coming, but not this, right?
Yeah,
like, not to this extent. I mean, I'm sure you guys live through the same things. There are days where you're just like, oh my God, like, we're not going to make it. You know, there's no way we're going to have to shut down. And literally 3 or 4 days later, you're like, oh my God, we're going to be $1 billion.
Yeah.
Like, all this great stuff, you know? And then 3 or 4 days later, you're like, we're not going to make it. Right. It's like, and it's not because you're flighty. It's because things change that fast. Like, good things happen and bad things happen. And you get a call from a big company and they want to do a partnership deal and everything else. And you get really excited and all the senior execs there, and you're like, oh, they're all good signs. And you walk to the end and then they decide not to do it. Right. And like, it's just like, oh. So I think that's one thing. The second thing, and this I really take from, I wish I had known this, but like, ride your winners, right? I think when you're on something that's working, take it as far as you can take it, because that's how you really build a reputation, make a lot of money. I mean, Backupify was doing $10 million in ARR when we sold it. And I was tired and I wanted to try something else. And I thought, oh, I've made so many mistakes. Like, I would go back now and I would be so much smarter. And then Tala was much less success. Tala was doing about $1 million when I walked away, you know, as a CEO, and hired somebody to do it. And so it's like, you know, you look at that Backupify number. Datto, the company that bought it, grew that at the time they IPO'd. The Backupify product was doing like $110 or $120 million for that in revenue. And I'm like, oh, like, that could have been us, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When I would really say, like, ride your winners when you're onto something. And look, it's hard to know, but if it feels like you're winning, like, don't have a grass is greener thing, you know, just stick with it.
wise words, my friend. Just to round it out here, what else do you want to mention or plug? I know you, I think you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you're doing some angel investing. Yeah, I wanted to give you an opportunity to plug anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably one of the most active AI-based angel investors in the country. I do about 30 investments a year and in a good year. And I'm, you know, very active in sort of all stages and sizes. So if you're doing something that's cool and unique, I like weird stuff. I like off-the-wall stuff. Definitely hit, you know, hit me up on Twitter, LinkedIn, or ask Justin for an introduction or whatever. I've done some really off-the-wall investments and I, you know, and they've been some of my best ones. So.
Awesome. Good stuff, Rob. Well, again, I really appreciate you coming on. Really, really cool to see what you're doing with Dianthus. Excited to track your journey, and we got to have you back on the pod here once you all hit 100 million.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Thanks for having me, Justin.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
All right. That is a wrap. Again, big shout out to my guy, Rob May, the team at Dianthus. Really appreciate you jumping on the podcast this week. Big week coming up. I'm going to be in Melbourne for the week, down under, catching up with the leadership team at Culture Amp. We've got a good episode coming up on Friday again, running it back with a founder whose company we featured on Monday Morning Quarterback. Pretty cool to have him on. It's going to be a really solid interview. I also had a piece that went up live on Entrepreneur last week, highlighting the time that I emailed all 30 NBA owners, the responses I got, and how that changed the trajectory of my life. Really special event for me, and just unpacking the process I went through to get in touch with a couple of mentors that have been pretty influential in my life. So check that out. Again, appreciate everybody tuning in, the time that you spend here every week. In the meantime, keep hustling, keep grinding, keep getting that money. Assassin state of mind, hustle, grind, see them dollar signs, assassin state of mind, assassin state of mind, hustle, grind, see them dollar signs way above the bottom line, assassin state of mind, hustle, grind, see them dollar signs, assassin state of mind, hustle, grind, see them dollar signs way above the bottom line, assassin state of mind. They say money over everything, in the game, shopping for a wedding ring, salary, startups, crypto, stock exchange, appreciate every penny, pocket change, one phone call, and your life can change, what's your love language, can't do business if it ain't reciprocated.